Thank you, Renate, for having me here in a different setting than usual for me. It's also my first time in the Perimeter Institute. Typically, I'm used to the fact that students for summer schools like this are selected on knowing having a high standard in theoretical physics, especially high energy physics. But the computational background is rather broad. So some of you are really good, and some of you have yet to gain more experience. And so I will start relatively light. Bear with me if you are at a higher level. The increase in the level will be steep, so at some point you will learn new things for sure. And ask questions if I'm not clear. Yeah? I like to have interactive lectures. The thing about computer simulations is that one can talk about it all day long, but that's not the way to learn how to do it. The way to learn how to do it is to do it, actually. And so the goal for me this morning is to use the two lectures I have to give you sufficient information so that this afternoon you can start programming. And then tomorrow I will use the lectures to raise the bar a bit for those of you who can handle that. And I should also say that the preconception of many people is that computational physics is about programming and finding bugs and so on. Typically, that's only step one, and the harder part is to do physics with it. And so I will also pay attention to how do you actually set up your simulations to actually extract the information that you want. And the topic that the topic of this morning lecture is first of all to start with a model that you probably are familiar with, but just to make sure that we speak the same language and so on. I will talk about the Ising model, which lends itself very well for all kinds of research and also is relatively easy to simulate. And then the second lecture of this morning is about Monte Carlo methods. And then just to give the overview, so Tuesday morning, in the first lecture, I will talk about cluster algorithms. And then, in the second part, finite size scaling, which is a very, very useful computational approach. And also in quantum gravity at some point. So that's the part. And then in the afternoon, there are tutorials, and Nylas will be my assistant. And you can raise your hand, so yeah. So we will do the exercise sessions together. So I don't know if, so how many of you did bring a laptop? And who did not bring a, well, that's good. okay. And so, for me, it's fine if you work on it individually. It's also fine if you do it together with somebody. If you actually do it together with somebody, and so you have a pair, then please let the person who is versed in programming be the one who types. Yeah, because otherwise, and it's too tempted to. Yeah, and if you are good in programming, restrict yourself and don't take over the keyboard, because that takes away the learning experience for the other person, yeah? Or you can do it individually, yeah? That's also fine. Okay, so other questions about the organization of the lectures? Does it sound like the right kind of topic? Okay, I see some people, few though, but okay, so the Ising model. So, So the IC model is a model of a magnet. And there are spins, sigma, and I is my index for the side, which is plus or minus 1. And that means that the spin is pointing up or down. And these spins are placed on a lattice. And that's why I need so many chalk, because they break all the time. Yeah. And so an important ingredient is that nearest neighbor spins like to be aligned. And so so basically, the Hamiltonian, which being a statistical physicist, for me is the function that gives you the energy, and this is only the potential energy, is some coupling constant J times the summation over all sides ij. And these brackets denote that I'm looking at nearest neighbor sides. And this is the product of the spins. And if you want to be precise, then you could add an external magnetic field as well. So this one is called coupling constant. And this is the external field, the strength of the external field. And so the Hamiltonian gives the energy of the state. So just to be sure, so actually, these 2 days I will work with zero external field. And so now if I look at this state, and so just a system with open boundaries, so what is the energy of this state? And now I'm looking at the guy on the last row with the green stuff. What is the energy? Yeah, you. Yeah, what is the energy of this spin configuration?
Diagonal ones, next neighbors?
No, okay. these we typically call the next nearest neighbors. So there's no interaction between them. Yeah. So do you need more time, or should I switch to your neighbor, who's writing right now? Do you know what is the energy of this state? Then the next. Yeah?
Zero.
And can you explain why is it zero?
Well, it's minus g for the first line and first term, then plus g for the second line and second term.
Yeah, that's right. So this is plus j, this is plus j. Sorry, this is minus j, and this is plus j, and this is plus j. So plus, plus, minus, minus. So this one has an energy which is zero. Yeah, and so now I look at your neighbor. So, what is the energy now? What is it? Sorry, 4J? Minus 4J. Yeah, yeah. And can your neighbor explain why this is minus 4J?
1 times 4.
Yeah. So okay. Anyway, yeah. So this is clear to everybody, right? So this is the energy of the spin state. Okay. And so now. Oh yeah, this one. I will get used to the blackboards, but. Yeah, so basically, we want to know what is the probability of a spin configuration. And I will just use capital C for the spin configuration. That one is determined by the Boltzmann rate. So the probability for configuration C is equal to 1 over Z, which is a boring normalization constant for computational physicists, times e to the power minus beta times the energy of configuration C. Yeah. So this is the Boltzmann probability. And beta, by definition, is KB, 1 over KBT. That's the inverse temperature. And so this is for practical purposes in computer simulation, a boring normalization constant, because the system is in some state. And so the probabilities have to add up to 1. But it's also known as the partition sum. And in theoretical physics, there's a lot of things to do about the partition sum, but not here right now. Okay, and so now, if we want to understand how the Ising model actually behaves, then it's good to look at, okay, suppose that I now look at like a 100 by 100 system of the Ising model. And I look at it at various temperatures. So here I look at the inverse temperature being 0, so that means infinite temperature. And here I look at infinite inverse temperature, so that means zero temperature. And this is like small beta, so T is high. And this is a special one that I will come to. And here I have beta large, so that means the temperature is low. So now, if I would just consider this as an experimental system, and I would look at the configuration in equilibrium at zero temperature, then how does the spin configuration look like? And so now I look at you. Yeah. So what? The temperature is zero. This is a. All the spins are aligned, yeah. So all are plus or all are minus. That's equivalent because there's no external field, yeah. And I will skip Timothy. Okay, yeah. And so that's because this is the state with the lowest energy. Huh? We tend to have a positive J, so yeah. And so now if I look at this, and now I look at you. Yeah, how does the configuration look like at high, at infinite temperature?
Probably something very random.
Yeah, yeah. So here, every state, since beta equals zero, every state has exactly the same weight. And so, if every state has the same weight, then it's just a random configuration. And so now, what happens once I go to slightly lower temperatures? Yeah.
You get domains of different spins?
Yeah, so almost, or yeah. So what you get is that neighboring spins have a tendency to be slightly aligned. But it's like 51% chance that they are aligned and 49% that they are anti-aligned or something like that. So you still have quite a random system, but there is a bit of a clustering going on. And so basically here, you start to have a correlation length that is small. Is that what you wanted to say? More or less, yeah. Okay. Okay, and so now if I go from here to here, what starts to change?
all spins are aligned anymore. You have some that turn around.
Yeah, so you do have like an enormous background of which is aligned, but there are some spins that are not following the general trend. Yeah? And it's simply because if you have like a 100 by 100 system, then the state with an anti-aligned spin has a higher energy and a much lower probability than the ground state. But there are 10,000 of them. And the combination of these 10,000 makes sure that you will have some opposing spins. Yeah? So it's not all aligned. And here you can also say that there is a correlation length which is rather small. And so then obviously, I mean, in the middle this starts to meet. So here the correlation length is zero, then it is small, and then it tends to grow. And so what we get here is quite a weird state in which you do have domains, but you have domains of all kinds of sizes. And so basically the correlation length has grown to be as large as the system is. And so that's known as the critical point of the IC model. And the fact that there is a critical point makes this model interesting. Yeah, this is all okay. So then we can look at various properties. For instance, we can look at the magnetization of the whole system, which is simply the sum of all spins. And then we often take the absolute value of this. Otherwise, the expectation value is rather boring because it always is zero because of symmetry. So now, if I do this as a function of beta, then Chris, can you identify? I mean, do you know how this looks like at either zero or infinite temperature?
So at beta equals zero, the magnetization will be zero because they
all. Yeah. Yeah, so it will be n, which is L times L. I will discuss the two-dimensional model because I can't make three-dimensional drawings. Yeah, and so it comes from close to this asymptotic value, and then it comes down, and it has to connect somewhere here. And so, Jordan, do you know how does this curve look like? So you say that it goes like this, and then it goes like this.
I think so.
Yeah? Do you agree with him?
No, there should be no jump.
There's no jump? Yeah. How does it go then? Like a sigmoid, or? Yeah, you gave the right thing. So it tends to go like this. So it there is no jump in here. It is a continuous curve. But it is strictly zero up to some point, which is what we call the critical point. And from there, it shoots up infinitely steep over zero range. Yeah, so that typically is the case in second order phase transitions, which is the case here. So there is a phase transition here. Up to here, the system is big enough, it has zero magnetization, but then suddenly there is one of the two spins that is winning, and it could be either of them. And so this is, for instance, the magnetization. We can also look at the expectation value of neighboring spins. So this is actually proportional to E. And so, can you say, do you know some of this curve? Now, I forgot your name. Andreas? No, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so. It's not that easy, huh? So, okay. So then I switch to Timothy.
Well, I would say it's a zero at zero.
Here it's a zero, yeah, that's right.
Maybe one at
And it goes to 1, huh, in the ground state. Yeah, and so this tends to have a peculiar shape. It looks like this, but then if you do simulations, then basically you see this. But if you zoom in, yeah, which is something which is very impractical to do in computer simulations, but if you zoom in, then at the critical point, and it is something that you will never get out of simulations by just looking at this plot, the curve is infinitely steep over zero range up there. Yeah? And so this happens to be a half times square root of 2. Yeah? And numerically, you never see this. I mean, you have to work to find this out. But it is infinitely steep over zero range. Just like, for instance, the 1 over... So the square root of x divided... let me think. The square root of x divided by... So some of these functions. So f x equals the square root of the absolute value of x. So x divided, something like this. Then you get kind of these weird kind of behavior. So, and then obviously it would also work if you make the quartic root out of that or so. And it turns out that here there is also some weird kind of root. But okay, we'll come to that. In a better way than I do now. Yeah? Okay. So there is a phase transition, and that makes this model interesting. And the things that are interesting here is that if you study this model, then you can see that the magnetization, for instance, tends to go like tc minus t to the power. And unfortunately, this exponent has gotten the name beta. And so I put a tilde on top of it to distinguish it from the inverse temperature. So this is like a critical exponent of this model. And also the specific heat, c, goes like T minus TC to the power minus alpha. Yeah, so here there is no minus sign because the magnetization goes to zero at the critical point. And here there is a minus sign, and that means that the specific heat diverges at the critical point. So sometimes there is a minus and sometimes there's not, and that is meaningful. Yeah, don't mix that up. And so the correlation length goes like t minus tc to the power minus nu. And so these exponents, this is the correlation length exponent, specific heat exponent, and the magnetization exponent. And the magnetic susceptibility also goes like with an exponent gamma. So now, I don't know exactly when, but I think it was sometime in the previous century that people started to actually measure these kind of exponents. So you can take a magnet and you heat it up slowly, slowly, slowly. And at some point you approach the Curie temperature and then the magnetization disappears. And you can look at the curve and characterize it. And so experimentally you can measure these exponents. And to the big surprise at that time, they found very weird values for these exponents. So for instance, beta is like 0.32 something. It wasn't 1/3, and so they didn't know why it had this weird value, because at that time they believed that mean field theory was exact, so they thought it should be a half, but the experiments never gave a half. And the big surprise was that if you took a completely different system, like the liquid gas transition, you would find the same numerical value up to all digits that they can experimentally measure of a number that didn't make any sense. And so that was the big mystery at that time. This was before Onsaker. So many systems share the same set of critical exponents and examples are the liquid gas phase transition, actually also the Ising model, magnets and critical opalescence. And there are more of them. And so the fact that you saw the same set of exponents coming back in completely unrelated models got the name universality. And so this is one of the key inventions in physics in the 20th century. And so the reason why this is important for us is that this allows us to actually use the Ising model and simulate it and study it to death, and then make predictions about completely different systems. Yeah. So if we want to know the behavior around the critical point, yeah, because it only works near the critical point, of liquid ethanol or something like that, then we do not have to go into detail and model the atomic structure of ethanol in our simulations. We can simply use the Ising model, which is way more convenient, and then actually make predictions about such complicated systems. So there is no point to dressing up the Ising model if you want to say some things about critical exponents anyway. You might just stick to the simple model. Yeah.
Is there some kind of criteria that you have to match to show that these exponents are going to be the same, or is it just accepted? Say you start out with a model that you're working on that's new.
Yeah.
How do you show that it has universality?
Yeah, so I would show it by just doing the simulations. And yeah, but no, I mean, there's a lot of deep physics behind this, and so renormalization theory and so on, and so you have how is it called? Marginal operators and so on. And so the theory behind all of this came later than the discovery of universality. And so there is a lot of folklore, or there is a lot of rules known about, so if you change dimensionality, you probably have a different universality class. If you introduce long-range interactions, you also can change the universality class. But as long as you have short-range interactions going down with a certain power, then you know it still is the same universality class. And so there are a lot of these kind of rules. And how they come is beyond this lecture. Yeah? Okay. Okay, and so.
Just a quick question, because you're talking about simulating this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like the Atlantic Ocean is not infinitely big either, huh? But okay. Yeah.
So how does it look? What if this is getting ahead, but how big is the simulation
have? Let's discuss this later, because we're now running into coffee time, so I think we'll come to that, but probably tomorrow when I talk about finite size scaling and how to extrapolate to the infinite system. Yeah? Okay, for the time being, you're happy? Yeah? Okay. Are there more questions until now? Yeah, so what I wanted to convey to you is that the Ising model has interesting properties because of universality. It only makes sense to study it around the critical temperature, because there it says something about the real world. And after the break, I will discuss, okay, how do you use computer simulations to study this? Yeah? And now it's time for coffee, I think. Oh, I'm too early.
You are ahead of yourself.
Oh, okay.
It's 9:30. It's 10 minutes.
9:30.
Oh, okay. So that's good. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Thank you. Yeah. So if there are questions, they're welcome. Yeah. If not, yeah. If not, I have prepared a little intermezzo, because I didn't know whether I would have run out of time or not. My planning was. Yeah, okay. So now just to also that you show that it makes sense to expect this universality between magnets and the liquid gas transition, we can look also at a different model and say that, okay, let's make a lattice gas model. So a lattice gas, and here we have particles Si, which is either 0 for the vacant site, or 1 for an occupied site. And so now, if we have these particles and we have a typical configuration looking like a particle here, and a particle here, and a particle here. So now, typically, if you look at the local energy of a pair ij as a function of, so ij is the, like the distance, so this is the distance between the particles, then you probably have learned in statistical physics that it probably looks like something like this, huh? Like the Lennard-Jones potential or something like that. So there, it is attractive at short range, and there is a repulsion, so there is a Pauli exclusion at short range. Yeah. So this is typically how particle systems look like or behave like, and then it depends on whether you have argon or something else, whether this shifts to the left or to the right, and also the vertical scaling. So now in our lattice gas model, we can simplify this a lot, because we are not interested in any distance below 1, because the first distance is 1. So we make a very simple potential. And so basically, at distance 1, it is minus epsilon. And at distance 0, it is infinite. So there are no two particles on the same side. And otherwise, they don't interact. Yeah, I mean, if we want to know universality properties, then the shape should not really matter too much. So why not take this simple shape? So now, if we have this system, then what is the energy of this state? And now I look at the guy with the Seattle shirt.
Right.
Yeah. So what's the energy of this system? With this potential between the particles.
Okay, and
so the Hamiltonian is going to be minus epsilon times the sum over neighboring sites, SISJ.
And the dot ball is an occupied?
Yeah, these are particles sitting on the letters.
How many neighboring? So it's a ball between, one ring between balls?
Yeah.
And how many?
Atoms, yeah.
And the only balls interact and the other, but it's just zero?
Yeah.
Okay, so
one,
and the distance
1
is in...
There it is minus epsilon, yeah.
Okay, so the minus epsilon is energy?
Yeah. Yeah, because the only interaction is... So the vacuum doesn't interact with itself, classical physics, huh? And so this contributes because these particles stick together, and that's the only thing. There's no interaction between them, so that's how you get this. Now, suppose you have this system and you have this Hamiltonian, then you can actually map one into the other simply by saying, if I take this system and I take Si is equal to, sigma I is equal to 2 times Si minus 1. So I just rewrite it in a different variable. And so if you plug this in here, and so this also means that Si is equal to 1/2 times sigma I plus 1/2. Yeah? So that if you plug this in here, then you can see that you can rewrite this Hamiltonian and you retrieve the one of the Ising model. And I will leave that to you. Yeah? It's not very complicated, but you will get an Ising model with some kind of external field that involves epsilon, etc. So then you can see that, okay, actually it makes sense that this lattice gas has the same properties as the Ising model because it has the same Hamiltonian. So you don't have to write a new program. You can use your old program and you just change the graphics. And so not surprisingly, that means you will get the same exponents, etc. Okay. Was this clear, or intermezzo was slightly less well prepared? But okay, so anyway. Yeah, now, and if you then do that, then basically for this model, the typical way of plotting things is slightly different. The conventional way is that now you have temperature here, and you have density here, rho. And rho here is the number of particles, which actually is like the magnetization in the Ising model. Yeah? And so then if you look at it, then the typical shape is something like this, where there is a gas phase here, and there is a liquid phase here, and there is the critical point here. And and here you tuned the external field such that this becomes nicely symmetric. Huh? And then you can see that this curve actually is the same as this one for the magnetizations and will have the same exponents, etc. Yeah, and so this is typically what you see in statistical physics textbooks of the van der Waals gas and so on.